Welcome to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour, along with Mike Murphy, who is engineering. Thank you for joining us and listening in. It's going to be a very sunny and mild week. At the beginning of the week, the temperature will be in the 70s during the day, but the heat will gradually climb as the week progresses until the weekend, when we should be up in the 80s during the days. Nights will be in the mid-50s. And like I said, blue skies. And there will not much more to say about the weather other than that. Good harvesting weather. I went to Madrid yesterday, and I saw that almost all the fields are harvested already. All the soybeans and most of the corn, not all. So harvest time is in full swing. It's going to be a time of harvesting for chipmunks, too, when I sit on the back patio of my father's house. The chipmunks are running around, and their cheeks are very full of nuts. I think they make little storage units of nuts, and I don't think they actually sleep all winter. They kind of drowsy during the winter, but they get up once in a while to go to the refrigerator and get a nut. Also, this is the thing about the chipmunks. I don't quite understand them, because when I sit on the back porch, they get very involved with me sitting back there. And they always come very close to me, and they run around me. And I can't figure out if they're trying to get me to leave, because I know they're very territorial. But yesterday, one of them sat on a bench across the patio from me and was eating his nuts on the bench and watching me. So it almost seemed like he didn't really want me to leave, like he was kind of having dinner with me. So I don't know. Chipmunks are interesting. They don't realize how cute they are. They think they're really big and tough. Anyway, I also wanted to say, on Thursday morning, I saw a mink in the little pond in my father's backyard. Really amazing. I'm sure he was looking for fish, although we don't have any. But yes, indeed, there was a mink there. Okay, here's Dennis Hart with a summary of the Iowa news from this past week. Take it away, Dennis.
A grim discovery in the hunt for a missing 11-year-old boy. The coronavirus continues to infect thousands, and the Field of Dreams has a new owner. All made big news across Iowa last week. First, the body of an adolescent was found near the hometown of a missing 11-year-old Montezuma, Iowa boy last Thursday. The clothing on the body was consistent with what Xavier Harrelson had been wearing when he was last seen on May 27th. Confirming the identity of the body could take 2 months or more. But officials notified Harrelson's family about the discovery. A farmer tending to his bean crop found the body about 4 miles from Xavier's home. Now, the coronavirus. The number of new cases in Iowa last week went down slightly, but remained over 10,000 for the third consecutive week. That's the first time Iowa has reported more than 10,000 new cases in three straight weeks since last year. The 10,182 cases reported last Wednesday brought the total number of positive tests to more than 488,000 since the pandemic started in Iowa. The state's 14-day positivity rate stayed at 9.5%. The health department also reported 81 more deaths from the virus, bringing the total number of people who died from it in Iowa to 6,563 since the pandemic started. And 624 Iowans were said to be hospitalized with the coronavirus. More than 81% of those hospitalized with it are not vaccinated. And 25 long-term care facilities in the state were said to be having outbreaks of the virus. About 66% of Iowans 18 and older are fully vaccinated. Also last week, a federal judge extended a temporary restraining order on the Iowa law banning mask mandates in school districts. That extension will last until next Monday, October 11th, when the judge will make a ruling on a preliminary injunction on the mask mandate law. The judge says enforcement of the law banning mask mandates continues to pose a threat of irreparable harm to children's health and rights. About 24 school districts in Iowa have put mask mandates in effect. In a related story last week, word that a University of Northern Iowa professor was relieved of his teaching duties for the rest of the semester, after he required masks in his classroom and threatened to lower students' grades if they did not wear one. Biology professor Steve O'Kane's rule went against policies imposed by the university and by the State Board of Regents. Also last week, word that nearly one quarter of Iowa public school students are in districts that have experienced significant coronavirus outbreaks this year. 11 school districts, including Waterloo, Sioux City, and Muscatine, reported more positive cases in the first month of this school year than during the entire previous year. 16 other districts, including Marshalltown, Des Moines, and Cedar Rapids, already have recorded coronavirus cases amounting to at least 50% of the tally for the entire last school year. There was still more about the virus last week, including word that the Des Moines Public Schools announced it would start offering public drive-through testing for the coronavirus at two sites within the district starting today. They will offer testing on the grounds of Hoover High School and the Kurtz Opportunity Center. And the Des Moines Register released a new Iowa poll last week about the virus. It showed that a quarter of Iowa adults do not plan to get vaccinated against it. 65% of the state's adults have received at least one dose of the vaccine, but among those who voted for then-President Trump last year, that figure drops to 48%. People who identify as Democrats are the most likely group to say they're already vaccinated or plan to be. 95% of Democrats say they have had at least one shot. Among those not taking the vaccine in Iowa, about 41% of the workers at the state-run Boys State Training School in Eldora. 74 of the 179 workers there have not been vaccinated. Six of the home's 52 youth have had the coronavirus in the past 3 months, along with 20 of the facility's 179 workers. Governor Reynolds says the state will not require workers in state-run facilities to get the vaccine. In yet another coronavirus-related story, word last week that rural Americans had been dying of the virus at rates twice as high as the rate of urban Americans. And the rate of infection was also higher in rural areas. In the early days of the pandemic last year, the virus swept through metropolitan areas first, and the rate of deaths and infections in those areas was higher than in rural areas. In other news last week, the U.S. Senate and House approved a short-term spending bill to avoid a government shutdown. In the Senate, every Democrat and 15 Republicans supported the bill, which passed on a 65-35 vote. Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst voted no. In the House, the bill passed 254-175, with every Democrat and 34 Republicans supporting it. Iowa's Republican congressional members all voted against it, while Democrat Cindy Axne supported it. Also last week, the FBI released statistics showing that Iowa's homicide rate reached a record high last year. There were 111 homicide offenses in the state in 2020, a nearly 60% hike from the year before. It's the biggest number of homicides in the state since the FBI began tracking the statistic in 1979. And when other violent crimes such as rape, robbery, and aggravated assault were included in the data, 2020 was the most violent year in Iowa's recent history. Across the nation, murders and other violent crimes increased last year. There was also word that the state of Iowa had ended its 2021 budget year with a surplus of more than $1 billion. Republicans, who control the legislature and the governor's office, said the surplus was due to conservative budgeting practices. Democrats said the budget looks rosier than it really is because Governor Reynolds shored up the state's finances with federal pandemic relief dollars that she had opposed. And the governor said the state would continue cutting taxes. Also last week, the Des Moines Register published another new Iowa poll, this one showing that the armed forces, local law enforcement, and the Iowa State Patrol lead the way as the institutions that Iowans trust most among 19 choices. The armed forces are trusted by 91% of state residents, followed by local law enforcement at 88% and the state patrol at 86%. The only other institution to crack the 80% trust level is respondents' local school districts. 60% of state residents say they strongly trust God. The least trusted institution among Iowans is social media. 87% of state residents say they distrust that. The second most distrusted institution in the state is cable news, with 66% saying they distrust that. On the court beat last week, one of the Iowa defendants in the January 6th insurrection at the nation's capital filed a motion saying that storming the Capitol did not amount to obstructing an official proceeding under federal criminal law. That's one of the seven charges Doug Jensen of Des Moines faces, and it's one that carries a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison. Meanwhile, last week, word that five female police officers and employees had sued the Des Moines Police Department for what they claim is sexual harassment, gender discrimination, and retaliation. Among other things, the lawsuit claims that numerous naked photos were sent to female employees by former Des Moines Police Bargaining Union President and police officer Stu Barnes, who then allegedly asked for naked photos in return. Barnes was allowed to retire without consequence last year. Still on the court beat, word that a former news director at WOI-TV in Des Moines had agreed to drop her gender discrimination lawsuit against the station's owner, Tegna. April Samp was fired in 2019, 5 years after she had joined the station. Her lawsuit had alleged she was one of several women older than 40 who had been forced out after Tegna took over the station, and that her age, gender, and advocacy for gender pay equity were behind her firing. Her case had been set for trial in December, but last week Samp and Tegna filed a joint agreement to dismiss the case. There was also word last week that the city of Des Moines would end its contract with a private security firm after a Des Moines Register investigation revealed certain comments made by that firm's CEO. Tom Conley of the Conley Group had sent emails to city officials saying those who took part in racial justice protests last year had engaged in what he called terrorism. There was also word that a Newton windblade factory might shut down, leaving nearly 800 workers without jobs. TPI Composites said the company does not have any business lined up for next year. In another story, an Iowa man was said to be appealing the suspension of his driver's license. He's arguing that he was driving 103 miles an hour in order to buy feminine hygiene products for his wife. He was pulled over in Lee County when authorities tracked him doing 103 in a 65-mile-an-hour traffic zone. In the world of college football, Iowa style this past weekend, Iowa State University demolished Kansas 59-7. The University of Iowa crushed Maryland 51-14 to stay undefeated. And the University of Northern Iowa destroyed Youngstown 34-7. And one more note from the sports world last week, word that Hall of Fame baseball player Frank Thomas announced he and his business partners have bought the controlling interest in the ownership of Iowa's iconic Field of Dreams in Dyersville. They will play a giant part in the future of the field, which includes more Major League Baseball games being played there, and adding youth baseball and softball fields adjacent to the site where the Kevin Costner movie Field of Dreams was filmed. And, just in case you're wondering, yes, Field of Dreams is one of my all-time favorite movies. And that is your summary of a busy, busy week of news from all across Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart. I've touched all the news bases this morning, and I'll come right back here tonight at 7 on KHOI's Capital Week when Laura Bellin and I will talk about what's been going on in Iowa politics and what it means for all of us. Then I'll show up again Friday morning at 7 here on Local Talk with word on what's making news in Ames. I hope you can be here for all of it, and I hope that you and I both have a great week.
Skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see. Blue birds singing a song, nothing but blue birds all day long. Never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by, when you're in love, my, how they fly. Blue days, all of them gone, nothing but blue skies from now on. so right, noticing the days hurrying by. When you're in love, they fly. Blue days, all of them gone. Nothing but blue skies. Right now, bidding ya da da da.
And that, of course, was the great Ella Fitzgerald with Blue Skies, going out to the beautiful fall weather that we're having in the middle of the harvest. And this is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. There's been a lot of events, changes, and controversy for the Ames School District during the past year. In this November's election, there'll be 7 candidates who have filed for 3 open seats on the school board. The open seats currently belong to Gina Perez, who has resigned and whose seat is temporarily being filled by Jane Acker, Monique Benkin, who is not running for re-election, Jamette Colton, who is also not running for re-election. Currently, the 7 candidates are Brett Becker, William Scott Dreyer, Rolf Duvick, Tom Pearl, Amy Erica Smith, Kira Weirstein, and Kelly Winfrey. We'll be speaking to as many of these candidates on Local Talk as will be available to speak with us. Today we welcome candidate Kelly Winfrey. Hello, Kelly. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kelly, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a mom. I think, you know, as we talk about school board, that's important. But I have a son who's 4 years old who just started at Northwood. So we're just starting our educational journey with him. I'm a professor at Iowa State in journalism and communication. And I also work with leadership studies and the CAT Center for Women in Politics. And I came to Ames in 2014 to work at Iowa State. My husband and I moved up here then. We really like it here. This is our home. This is where we plan to spend hopefully the rest of our lives and have our son go to school. That's kind of in a nutshell. I'm someone who cares a lot about public service. That's why my academic research and the outreach I do focuses on encouraging other folks to get involved in politics and the political system. And I'm taking my own advice.
What sparked your wanting to do this, to run for the school board?
Well, I think there are a few things. I think first and foremost, it was that we had 3 open seats. I think that our current board's done a good job. If these people were running for re-election, I probably wouldn't be running. So I think that was part of it. And then there were some other circumstances that made me feel like now was a good time. One is that we are going to be hiring a new superintendent. And that is, I'd say, the most important job of the school board. And it can have really long-lasting implications for the community. A couple other things that motivated me to run were issues with the pandemic. You know, it's obviously been a very challenging time for everyone. And we've had extra challenges brought on by the state with, you know, limiting mask options and some other issues. So I think I'm someone who can help navigate those challenges. And so I think, you know, the timing really, I wasn't planning to run in June. By the end of July, I decided to run. And I think it largely has to do with kind of standing up and helping to navigate these challenges and bring on a new superintendent that will keep our school district going in the right direction.
Well, okay, let me ask you first, why do you believe that you're qualified to be on the school board?
That's a good question. I think for me, first and foremost, the school board should be representative of the community. And I think that I can represent Ames values and priorities well. I am someone who listens and does research, and I try to make decisions based on evidence. And I'm committed to the community as a whole. You know, I think it's important as a board member, you know, if you have kids, of course, you think about your own kids. But also, as a board member, you're not there as a representative of your child. You're there as a representative of all of the children in the community. That's something that I think I can keep in mind and help inform my decisions. I think the other thing is I have a good understanding of how the school board works. You know, it's a collaborative body. Everybody's one vote. Everybody needs to work together to solve problems. And I come to the board with those things in mind, ready to work as a team member.
So you mentioned values. So obviously you would be representing some values of some sort. What type of change would you bring to the board?
Like I said, I don't think that the board has done a bad job. I think that for me, one of the unique things I bring is an ability to come up with creative solutions to problems. As we are faced with challenges from the pandemic or push back about what sort of curriculum we should have, I think there's a need to figure out how we can navigate those challenges and come up with ways that we can work within the law to still do the things that we think are important. And so that's one thing I think I bring. And otherwise, I think that I just add another perspective to the board. I don't know that it's a big change, you know, as one member can change a board completely, but I can bring a different perspective about how we might address some of the problems.
So you said earlier that you really felt that the school board had done a good job recently. Is there anything you believe that they should have done differently in the past year?
Well, I have the gift of hindsight, right?
That's right.
I think that the board generally has done a good job with the information they had at the time. That's changed, right? Last spring, we had hoped that the pandemic would be pretty much over by now and that we could return to normal. And then we had the Delta variant pop up kind of right before classes started. And that caused some challenges because people were concerned, again, about sending their kids to school, especially without the ability to require masks. So, you know, in hindsight, I think that, or maybe what we learned from this situation is that we shouldn't assume that things are over, that this might be a problem for a while that we're going to have to keep navigating. So kind of have more contingency plans. If X happens, then here's how we can handle it. The other thing I think I probably would have brought to the board is I think I would have pushed harder for doing more with masks at the beginning. We got lucky that a federal court put a restraining order on the mask, the ban on mask requirements, which seems like a weird phrase. But I think that there's an opportunity to work within the law to push a little harder. The way the law is written, you know, we could have tried to do some incentive programs and things like that that would be within the bounds of the law, but maybe increased mask wearing. Fortunately, we didn't have to do that, but I think, you know, that's the sort of creative problem solving I think that we need to think about. Okay, we have this situation. How do we get around it to do what we need to do to keep our kids safe? That's one of the ways I think I could have helped a little bit.
So you're focusing on the issue of safety. We've also learned that another side effect of the coronavirus and just kind of all of the events of the past year have been very stressful for young people. We've had reports of increased violence at the schools. Recently, a teacher was punched. There's also been some reports of sexual assault. What are your thoughts on the issue of mental health and just how to address this?
Yeah. This is a question and this is an issue I've talked to a lot of people about in the past few weeks because it is certainly an issue of concern. And I think, as you mentioned, you know, mental health is an important part of this. The fights and behavior issues at the high school and some at the middle school, I think, are symptoms of a larger problem. And some of that is, like you said, coming out of the pandemic, there is an increased stress on students' mental health. Students have been, you know, largely kind of locked away at home for a year and a half. And so kind of re-socializing into the school environment is a challenge. And that's something that they need help and support with. I think the influence of social media is certainly, you know, an ever-changing problem. You know, TikTok challenges and things like that have contributed to some of the problems at the schools. So as administrators and as a school board, I think that we need to be figuring out what kind of how do we adjust our policies? How do we adjust our expectations and consistently apply those expectations and consequences so that students know what to expect, know what will happen, and can act accordingly, but also provide the support, you know, mental health support and support from faculty, from teachers and administrators to help students get what they need to be successful. This is a challenging time for young people. And I think that all the stress that we feel as adults, imagine being someone who's developing socially, physically, all of that during this difficult time. And so providing support for those students, I think, is important. You know, I think we have, I believe, 4 mental health counselors at the high school, which is good, but I think we need more mental health support to help students that are navigating some of these challenges.
Do you see the school board as having a role in helping with that, or you think that's more the job of the management at the schools?
The way that the school board can help is to help highlight some ways that administrators could, you know, shift their focus. But most of these things are decisions made by administrators. So the superintendent, building administrators, principals, and things like that. Where the school board can help, though, too, is in allocating resources. It's not something we can do tomorrow. But as we think about how we use our resources, where should we be putting our money and what kind of support services do we need in different buildings? Those are decisions the board can help with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the more divisive issues that happened with the last school board was the Black Lives Matter week months. Do you believe that the board handled that well?
Initially, this was a decision that was made by the superintendent and the board supported, which I supported as well. I think that the way that it was done was not great. It needed to be communicated more clearly to the public, to parents, what we were doing and why we were doing it. Teachers needed to be prepared for how to teach that sort of curriculum and what the expectations were and best practices are for doing those things. So in all, I don't think it was handled great, but I don't think that all of that falls on the board either. I think it was a learning experience and that, hopefully we learned some lessons about how to communicate to the community about what we're doing and why.
Do you think the district should teach concepts such as racial justice or equity in class?
Absolutely. I think that, in large part, these are issues that are ingrained to the things that we should be teaching anyway, history, social studies, civics education. And part of what we're doing in schools is, we're teaching information, but we're also teaching socialization. So how do we exist in a community with other people? How do we appreciate and value each other? How do we do what's best for our community as a whole? And these are topics that need to be discussed so that we can build a better community. One of the things I'd like to do as a board member is to help develop a more long-term plan about how we can integrate these things into our curriculum at different levels and also work with the community to help bring the community along and understanding the complexity of some of these issues. This is one of the kind of big issues for me because it's something I think is really important. And for a lot of us, these are not topics that we learn in middle school or high school either. So making sure that parents and community members have an opportunity to learn with their children and apply this information, I think could be really helpful. I think we have a community that largely has really good intentions and wants to be kind and accepting and celebrate the others in the community, but we should all be learning as part of this process. So it's a big ask, but I think if we are intentional, then we can do some good work for our students and our community.
Well, based on what you said before about wanting to be part of choosing the new superintendent, is it fair to guess that this would be one of the things you would be looking at in a new superintendent is that person's ability to navigate that process?
Yes, certainly. Mm-hmm. I think hiring a superintendent is going to be, there's a lot of things we all want, but I think a superintendent who has some experience in implementing curriculum like this and preparing other administrators and teachers to do that is important. And also administrators who are superintendent candidates who have experience in addressing inequities within education. So disparities in grades and outcomes for students based on race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status. I'll be looking for someone who has some expertise and experience that they can bring to help, keep pushing our district in the right direction.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm speaking with Kelly Winfrey, who's running for the Ames School Board. One more quick question. There is a group in Ames called Ames Deserves Better who is asserting that the district is losing ground in academic achievement. Do you agree with that assertion, and are you seeking support of that group?
I'm absolutely not seeking support of that group. I've looked at their website and checked facts, and there's a lot of misinformation or misleading information on their website. And even if you click on some of the support they have, you'll find that it actually says the opposite. So, for example, the claim that test scores have gone down, if you look at the presentation from the administrators from the middle school and high school, they actually say that test scores have remained relatively stable, even during the pandemic. The other thing is, I think the house has been on fire. There's been a pandemic. Students across the country have had a harder time learning and adapting in the past year and a half. And that's something that we're addressing as we get them back to school. But it's not something that's unique to Ames or anything that Ames has done. In fact, I think the fact that we've remained relatively consistent is evidence that we're doing a pretty good job.
Okay, well, thank you. I have been speaking with Kelly Winfrey. Thank you for joining us this morning and for volunteering for public service here in Ames and running for the school board. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg, for this hour, and I'm here with Mike Murphy, Engineering. Mike, you're not a native to Iowa, but I've heard you say several times that you have really come to love the big birds here in Iowa. Is that true?
Well, yeah, all the birds, really. But yeah, it is amazing. I never grow tired of seeing the birds and hearing the birds. And
nothing like driving down the street and seeing a red-tailed hawk sitting on top of the light post, right?
Right. It's amazing. Like it's, yeah. And remember, you and I last year went to Iowa State to cover students coming back in a pandemic, and there was a red-tailed hawk we
living
chased after.
Right, living on campus, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it is one of our great pleasures here, these big birds. And someone who is responsible for helping to keep the big birds in Iowa is Terry Huffer. Terry is a volunteer at SOAR, which is an acronym for Saving Our Avian Resources. And I was with Terry and many others yesterday afternoon at an event hosted by the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. This was at the newly acquired land on the Des Moines River, formerly known as the 4-H Camp. And SOAR released some big birds there for all of us to watch. A spectacular event. Terry is here with us. Thanks for coming, Terry. You described it as a beautiful ceremony to give the camp a new life and new meaning. So tell us what was going on yesterday.
Well, a few years ago, SOAR started to have an annual release party. It was a way to get people a chance to make it to see one of these birds, because K rehabilitates so many birds every year. And so we started
is Kay Newman, who's the director of SOAR, right?
She is the director, and she is the chief medical officer. She is the one who really does most of the rehabilitation. She's the one who started SOAR, and she's been doing it since 1990. So
I was there yesterday with the recorder, and I want to share just a brief clip from what I recorded yesterday at the bird release that happened. This is when a bald eagle got released, and there were a number of birds that got released. Tell us first who all got released before I play the clip.
Kay had brought two screech owls, which are small little birds, which are only about this big.
With very big eyes.
Yes, with really big eyes, but they're only about, you know, like...
They look like cartoon characters.
They were, and we all, every single time, everybody's like, is that a baby owl? And it's like, no, actually, every bird, when it has to leave the nest, it actually has to be full grown size-wise. It might not have its adult coloration, but it's full grown. It won't get any bigger. So these little tiny owls, one was red and one was gray, because we have both color phases in Iowa. So they're a cute little owl, and they have little feather tufts that stick up like the great horned owls do. And so she released those close to the woods so they could quickly get into the woods and get under some cover. And then the next releases were two barred owls, which barred owls are really beautiful owls, and they're the ones that say, ooh, 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 who cooks for you?
Who cooks for you, right?
And they have brown eyes and a yellow beak, and they're opposite from great horns, who have yellow eyes and a black beak. But anyway, so we released those two, and then also two red-tailed hawks. One was a juvenile and one was an adult, but kind of a young adult, because you can tell by the eye color kind of, you know, if they're kind of a younger bird or an older bird. And this bird still has some yellow in its eyes. So that was really cool. And then a very feisty bald eagle.
Very feisty. It was batting around in a cage like a bear in there. Okay, well, let's play this clip of the bald eagle being released. What you're going to first hear is the police officer who was first notified that somebody had hit the bird with a car. And then you hear Kay Newman, the director of SOAR, describing the rehabilitation of the bird, and then some reactions to the release.
I am Kira Lazmi, Deputy Lazmi with Jasper County. We don't typically get calls for animals. It usually goes straight to DNR or conservation, but time of night, nobody was in the county but deputies. So a citizen called because they had hit an eagle, and it just fortunately happened to be like 2 miles from my house. So while en route, I also gathered up a dog crate
and a helper
and some gloves, obviously not the right kind of stuff to catch an eagle. But so when we got there, she was down off a bridge. She had gotten into a stream or kind of like a small river, and she climbed up on a bank. And so We had to climb down in there. We kind of took our boots and rolled up our pants and waded through the water, kind of shimmied the crate. And long story short, we ended up getting her in the crate. And by this time, we had four deputies that helped us carry her up the side of a steep side of a hill. Called around, DNR wasn't available. Our conservation officer was out of town. We also got a hold of a different county's conservation who knew Deb. My understanding is she helps out with SOAR. Deb was willing to meet me that night, so I satcheled down the crate with the eagle, Jade. Our department kind of has named her Jade, just in the back of my truck, and I met Deb around midnight down in Bondurant. Yeah.
When you get hit by a car, yeah, well, just think about that. You know, there could be internal injuries. There could be broken bones. There could be concussion. There could be all sorts of things going on. So when I got her the next morning, she had road rash just down her chest, like embedded pieces of gravel in her chest and her wrist. So this little... The bird wings are like our arms, and so the wrist actually ends up being the joint that is closest up here to their face. And so she must have just skidded on the side of the road somehow and then embedded gravel. So saline and all sorts of rinses and a little antibiotics, and we got her into the flight pen, and she's feeling much, much better. So this all happened in the middle of August, so we've had her for about a month and a half. This is an 11-pound adult female bald eagle. And she's just going to walk out of the crate on her own, and we'll watch her fly away from there. You guys know when you approach that eagle, even though she was laid out on the ground, they are bigger than everything else you've seen so far. And so we are always extra, extra, extra careful. So I think she's ready to go. We're going to try to face her.
Yeah, now everybody just stay... Stay where you're at. Yeah, now we can clap, right, Kay? Yes, yes.
I didn't even have to hold the door open.
No.
Like,
no. No. She was ready to go. Yeah. She was ready to go.
It was amazing. It was just like, just an instant freedom for it, you know. It's just like, incredible. I love it.
Kay, what's it like for you when the birds get released?
Well, it's the reason why I do rehabilitation, really, is because this is the fun part. And you know they're nervous, and then you let them go, and so you're gifting them the thing that they want the most, is to be free. It's a beautiful day. I'm going to go sit by the river. Nobody's going to tell me what to do today. I get to decide, you know? So,
yeah, perfect.
And so this is absolutely the reward for all the other stuff that we end up doing.
Okay, that last part was, again, Kay Newman, who is the director of SOAR, Saving Our Avian Resources. And I'm here with Terry Hofer, who is with SOAR. You're a volunteer, Terry. Thanks for joining us. So that's awfully fun to listen to, right?
It is. That was great.
It's the sound of freedom. One of the things that I'm curious if you could answer is, you know, Kay did talk at the end about that this is a pretty big animal, and she had only been with you for a few months, so she was quite a wild animal. And we definitely saw that because she was making the cage rock a lot with her movements inside. But she was also describing how they, you know, were disinfecting her body after she got gravel embedded. How do you actually treat an animal like that without getting hurt? That's a big, fierce animal with a big beak.
Oh my gosh. And their feet are oftentimes, you know, the talons are extremely sharp. And yeah, and Kay is so good. So some background on Kay. She's a wildlife biologist. She got her master's here at Iowa State. And she was also a falconer in college. And she had experience working with birds like this. And then, you know, people started bringing her birds because in the conservation board system, she worked for a county conservation board. And you know, you get to meet, you know, you have the Iowa County Conservation Board meetings, and so you kind of get to know everybody, and everybody's bringing Kay birds. So she's been working with birds for probably 30 years now. So she's kind of like, you know, the raptor person for you know, the most knowledgeable. She's just incredible. And so quite often, you know, she's spent most of these years doing stuff on her own, but she has her kids now. Her daughter lives nearby and will often assist, but quite often Kay's in there doing it on her own. There are special wraps you can put around a bird to help close their wings in and stuff. And there's special ways to hold them and protect yourself. And quite often she'll wear a heavy Carhartt coat when handling the birds. And back in the old days, we didn't have them, but, you know, face shields protect your face from any, you know.
So she doesn't sedate the eagle when she's cleaning it, does she?
No.
It must be quite something, though, even with all that protection, because that's a big animal.
It is. And that one, you know, because it was only in rehab for, what, since August, so less than 2 months, really. And so no broken bones. And as big as she was, I mean, just a big bird. Yeah, that one would have been a very hard one to work on.
Now, Kay works with raptors. I think we were told yesterday that when people bring songbirds to SOAR that they go to another group in Des Moines, right? You specialize in raptors.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a wonderful rehabilitator, Jenny B, we call her because she's got a long last name. Anyway, she takes care of all the songbirds, but quite often she'll get a great blue heron or a pelican or something too that she'll help with. And she's extremely knowledgeable and wonderful.
Most of the birds you get are red-tailed hawks. Is that true?
That is like the largest group of birds. Buteos are the most common, and red-tails are the most common buteo. And so they quite often are. But and then a lot of great horned owls, and we get a lot of them, especially hatchlings, you know, or fledglings. We'll get a lot of those.
The eagle that we heard in the clip, that was reported by somebody who had hit the eagle with a car. Do most of the birds come to SOAR from individuals, or do they come from the DNR or the police?
Yep. So,
all of the above.
Right, yeah. It's not very often that the person who actually hits the bird, you know, is the one who gets it to us. Either they don't know they've hit it, or, you know, usually somebody else finds it. So this person, you know, knew that they had hit it and did their due diligence, and we're really grateful for them because, you know, a lot of times they get hit and then they don't get found for a few days, and then they start to get emaciated and they lose their muscle mass, and Kay can feel on their keel, which is, you know, the bone that their wing muscles attach to, how thin they are. And they get to a point where they're so thin their organs start to shut down and they can't digest any food. And so you can't even feed them because they're just too far gone. Mm-hmm. And you have to try some liquid or whatever diet and hopes that to get their systems going again.
Why are you a volunteer at SOAR? What do you get out of it?
So my role has changed. So I've volunteered since 2004, and I just had the opportunity, you know, had run into Kay again, and because we had known each other earlier, and I had some time, and she lives kind of far away from here and stuff, but I was able to just, like, drive over and help clean cages and pick up birds, and I did programs. I did lots of programs for Kay, and which is really fun, and people are always rapt with attention because, you know, too bad I don't have a bird here, you know, to have on my hand that you can't see it on the radio, but on the Zoom you can. So did lots of programming for Kay, and now with my new job in the last few years, I don't do it as much. But my house happens to be, so Lynette Bernard, she is our communications guru, and she lives about an hour and a half east of Ames, and Kay is an hour and a half west of Ames, and my house is right in the middle. So quite often there's bald eagles in my driveway getting transferred from one vehicle to another in the Pony Express.
So what do you get out of it?
It's just wonderful. Yeah, no, so my degree is wildlife biology, and, you know, I just always had a love for animals, and, I guess I can't answer it because it's, you know, it's just a good feeling, and trying to help, you know, one bird at a time, and sometimes I have to feed the birds that are in my garage and, you know, try to keep them alive until I can get them to Kay.
Well, it's a connection to nature, right?
It's such an honor to be in their presence, in this wild animal, and to hope, I don't know, it's just to be able to have a connection to nature and the environment. And the environment is so important right now. It's always been important. When I became a naturalist in 1990, that was the 20th year or anniversary of Earth Day. And here it is 32 years later, 31 years later, and we still are in this predicament, and we haven't learned enough, and we haven't changed our lifestyles enough to slow down climate change and everything. But helping one bird, you know, that means a lot to that one bird. You know, it's the old starfish parable, you know. Well, it matters to that starfish that I threw it back in the ocean. So,
yeah, well, we saw a bunch of birds being thrown back into the air yesterday, which was a beautiful sight. And this was at the old 4-H camp, which has recently been acquired by the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. And you mentioned yesterday that you actually were a camp counselor there. So tune in to Local Talk on Friday. Pat Schlarbaum is going to talk more about the 4-H camp, its past, and its exciting future. So thank you so much. I've been speaking with Terry Hofer, who is with SOAR, Save Our Avian Resources. And thanks so much for joining us, Terry.
You bet.
Telling us about the big birds. This is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the hour, and we are coming around to the end of the show, but I wanted to share one more thing with you that I really loved. The Ames Downtown Farmers Market is still happening on Saturdays here on Main Street, and Darla Best is someone that you will find there. She's not a farmer. She sells wares, but not just any wares. These are from the Amish. And I've always found them very beautiful. And so last Saturday, I finally asked Darla to come to Local Talk to tell us about this. Welcome, Darla.
Thank you.
Nice to hear your voice, Darla. First off, you are not Amish, right? You're from Ames?
That's correct. Well, I grew up in Manson, which is about an hour and a half northwest of here, but I've lived in Ames since 1979.
Describe what you are selling.
Okay, I sell products that are handcrafted by Amish families. And those products include many shapes and sizes of baskets, loom-woven rugs, cutting boards, rolling pins, red cedar jewelry logs, plus aprons and pot holders that are sewn on old-fashioned treadle sewing machines.
So who are the people that make these? Are these particular families, or is this a community?
They are mostly old-order Amish families who don't have electricity, running water, or phones. They travel by horse and buggy, heat their houses with wood-burning stoves, and their children go to first through eighth grade in one-room schoolhouses, and that concludes their formal education. They also speak German or Pennsylvania Dutch until they go to school, and I enjoy stopping at their schools. I take them school supplies and treats, and then sometimes I get to play baseball with them at recess.
Well, this is a really kind of a unique and separate community that you're describing. How did you get involved doing this? How did you start connecting with them?
Well, I got started when a very good friend that I grew up with in Manson met one of the families selling along the roadside 19 years ago, and he showed me the baskets he had purchased, and I was not into baskets at all, but my church here in Ames, Bethesda Lutheran, was holding our annual Scandinavian coffee fundraiser, and someone suggested that I consign baskets at the gift shop. So I ordered some baskets by mailing a letter to one of the Amish families, and that was the first of hundreds of letters that I've written. You know, since they don't have email, and then started our own business of selling the products at farmers markets and craft shows.
And what kind of a response do you get for the products?
Oh, people love them, especially, you know, when I kind of tell them about, you know, the background and that I've known these families. And some people are just amazed. They're like, oh, you really know them? I said, oh, yes, you know, for 19 years. And I call them my families because they are like family to me. And always will be. Even when I stop selling the products, I'll always stay in touch with them. And I kind of laugh when I tell people, too, even their dogs know my van because I bring them dog treats all the time. So they come running, and the children all come running because I bring them treats every time also.
Can you describe maybe one of the families to help us kind of visualize a little bit better who these people are?
Well, they live on farms, obviously. They do not live in towns. And it's actually the farms are down near Lamoni, which is located in southern Iowa, down by the Missouri border. They're very close-knit and supportive of each other. And they, you know, help each other out when someone is in need. And they're very religious. They kind of go by, you know, specific rules that they have.
What do you gain from knowing them?
Oh, just the friendship, you know, I've developed. I feel very blessed with the wonderful relationship that I have with all these families. It's just amazing. Like I said, I feel very blessed that I get to work with them, help them out, because unlike we as Englishers, that's what we're called. Mm-hmm. They call us English. They do not have the outside jobs like we do. And so their young men learn a trade to support their families when they get married. And some of those include like basket weaving, building furniture or buggies, training horses or selling baked goods. And then their women don't hold jobs since they are very busy taking care of their family, which typically consists of many children. And those children are usually born at their homes. Also, when I was talking about them being religious, they hold church services every other Sunday, but they do not have actual church buildings. They take turns holding the services at their houses. And that is also where their weddings are held. And then I've been very fortunate to have been invited to several of those weddings.
Wow. Well, it's really interesting to hear just a snapshot of this. Darla, maybe I can have you back sometime when we have more time to kind of tell us more about it. It's really a part of Iowa that's somewhat mysterious to many of us. But before we go, tell us again where you can find the products that you're selling.
Okay, I have a display at the Indoor Farmers Market at the North Grand Mall here in Ames, where we are open Fridays through Sundays year-round, plus expanded hours during the Christmas holiday. And then I also sell at the Ames Main Street Farmers Market or the downtown Des Moines Farmers Market on Saturdays. And then this year I also sold at the Valley Junction Farmers Market in West Des Moines every other Thursday. And then also for many years I've had a booth at Santa's Workshop held at three schools in Ankeny the first Saturday of November, and at the Nevada High School the second weekend of November.
Okay, thank you. And again, the farmers market is still happening in downtown Ames, so you'll be there on next Saturday, right?
Yes, I'll be there the next two Saturdays, and then that will be the end of the outdoor market.
Okay, thank you. I've been speaking with Darla Best, who is a merchant of Amish wares. And thank you so much just for giving us a glimpse into the other world here in Iowa. And our show is coming to an end. So you've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and engineered by Mike Murphy. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again on the radio. And this is KHOI Story City Ames.